Hello, and welcome to episode 156 of Public Interest Podcast with your host, Jordan Cooper, where we interview politicians, activists, advocates, and others who seek to improve the state of the world. We're here today with Dr. Atul Grover, the Executive Vice President at the Association for American Medical Colleges, or AAMC, the former Chief Public Policy Officer and former Chief Advocacy Officer at AAMC, the former Chief Medical Officer at the Health Resources and Services Administration's Center for Workforce Studies, also known as HRSA, and Atul is currently an adjunct professor at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health and the George Washington University School of Medicine. Atul, thank you for joining us. How are you doing today?
Great. Thanks, Jordan.
Excellent. The first question I'd like to pose to you is, what are you currently doing or what have you ever done to advance the public interest and why?
Yeah, so I think in your category of people to interview, I'm the and others. At the Association of American Medical Colleges, we represent the 147 medical schools in the United States that grant MDs, mm-hmm. and about 400 major teaching hospitals and health systems. So they're kind of your household names. If you look down the street here where we are, mm-hmm. it's Howard and Hopkins and Maryland, GW, Georgetown, mm-hmm. But also places like Hospital Center that are big training programs. We do a predominant amount of the training of the next generation of the healthcare workforce in the United States. That's not just physicians, it's nurses, allied health professionals, social workers, pharmacists. We also do a majority of the funded research outside of the NIH that the NIH funds, so we call extramurally funded research. That actually gets carried out at the nation's universities and academic medical centers. Mm-hmm. And then we provide some very unique clinical care. We're large. We have a large footprint. We care for anywhere between 20 and 25% of all the clinical care in the country. And we provide almost 100%. And just these are 400 health systems out of the, say, 5,000 acute care hospitals, or about 5 or 6% of all the institutions. But again, we're large, and we do the stuff that others can't or won't do. So in terms of the clinical care arena, every time you see a tornado, a human-created mass violence incident, a natural one, we're the ones that are there when things are at their worst, we're at our best.
So AAMC represents only 5% of hospitals, perhaps a much greater proportion of total patients and total dollars spent in the inpatient care setting.
Absolutely. And so that care is also not only highly specialized, so most, not all, the level one trauma centers, transplants, that kind of thing. But we also are able to, because of our size and because of our missions, put money back into those services that are often, we call, loss leaders in the community, those things that we know we're never going to make a margin on. So inpatient psych beds and, you know, substance abuse clinics, geriatric psychiatry clinics, all kinds of things. A lot of the specialized care to children, particularly mm-hmm. given through the Medicaid program, we know is a loss leader. But
why would those be money-losing service lines on the one hand, and on the other hand, why would academic medical centers take on money-losing service lines, considering that healthcare is increasingly a business? And actually, has always been a business.
Yeah, well, the great thing is the people that I work for in these institutions mm-hmm. are there because they want to do these things. These things are important to them, and they're important to me, which is why I do what I do. So it's a long answer to your short question about what do I do to make the world a better place, as I help the people in these institutions actually do their jobs. Now, why are they loss leaders? Mm-hmm. It's because generally, if you look at state Medicaid programs, in many cases on the hospital side, the inpatient side, the reimbursement is about the same as Medicare, maybe a couple of cents less on the dollar. So still at a loss, but not a huge loss.
Right.
For the physician care, for some of these other specialized services, we lose money. I believe if the states had the money, mm-hmm. they would want to actually spend on these services for the most vulnerable in their populations, but they don't.
So is it public or private health insurance companies, which we'll heretofore refer to as payers, are they public or private payers that are setting these money-losing reimbursement rates? And then alternatively, are reimbursement rates for other services higher than the actual cost of providing the services to therefore cross-subsidize these money-losing services?
So it's very unusual that the rates are set across the board. Maryland is one of those few exceptions. Mm-hmm. So with their waiver, there is a hospital payment rate, which everybody pays, whether you're talking about Medicare, Medicaid, or private payers. In every other case, it is incredibly confusing for the average person, much less anybody who does this stuff for a living, because there are charges, what physicians or hospitals charge, which no one pays except for the poor person who comes in that doesn't have insurance and doesn't know, because there's six layers of billing to mm-hmm. say, hey, give me whatever lowest rate you've negotiated with a payer, whether it's Medicaid or somebody else, and don't charge me this sort of off-the-shelf, off-the-rack rate.
Can an uninsured person say that and actually be granted that request?
Yes. Whether they'll be granted that request by a particular physician or hospital or other provider, that's up to that provider. But I certainly know of people who, before we had ACA, and people who...
Which is the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare for our listeners.
Yeah, and people who have gone without insurance, or unfortunately not had insurance, and they have been able to have this kind of negotiation. It's harder to do, I would say, with kind of a smaller office. They're just kind of unprepared to figure this stuff out.
Yeah.
But so within the system, Medicare sets rates. Medicare sets rates. Every other rate with a private payer is negotiated between the provider and the payer. Mm-hmm. And in terms of your question about, is there cross-subsidization? Yes. Not necessarily between the same payer, because we tend to lose money overall on Medicare and Medicaid. But where we negotiate higher rates is with the private payers, particularly our institutions, because they are such vital providers of services that aren't available outside of their institutions. They often have to be kept within a payer network.
So on this topic of pricing variance, it's curious. You've said that your... So first of all, the AAMC is a membership-based organization.
Right. So our members are the institutions, not the people. It's the schools and the hospitals and health systems.
So the institutions pay membership fees and become part of the AAMC. You represent them and try to advocate. And one of the things that membership gives to these member organizations is advocacy efforts, especially on the federal level. So you're advocating for higher Medicare or Medicaid reimbursement levels, yet you're saying that some of the service lines are money-losing service lines, and some, and then generally you said that often Medicare or Medicaid reimbursement rates are not sufficiently high enough to cover the cost.
Right.
So what's the incentive to take Medicare or Medicaid public programs?
Well, you know, if you look at economic theory and sort of why organizations or people do things, there's sort of that... our friend Jerry Anderson taught me this.
A professor at the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health.
Health economist. If you look at something like the motivation of profit maximization, mm-hmm. it's not us. We're not a for-profit firm. We have no residual claimant. We do not have shareholders. These are organizations that are operating for the public good. They don't keep their profits. They don't distribute them to shareholders. They put them back into research, teaching, and clinical care. That's why we do what we do. That's why we're there. That's why we attract people. And quite frankly, our ability to do this is made off the backs of the people who are willing, our faculty, physicians, our other staff, who are willing to take less money in compensation than they would otherwise make in the private sector, perhaps at a for-profit institution across the street, because these missions are important to them.
Now, academic medical centers do get higher reimbursement rates than non-academic medical center hospitals that are providing the same services, correct?
In Maryland?
Or in the country?
Well, they're outside of the reimbursement, the straight reimbursement, we've created add-on payments for policy reasons. Let's talk about the Medicare system here and keep it to that, because that's uniform and it's national. And so if you control for things like local wage indexes, labor costs, that kind of thing, and were to compare all the total fees received by one of our institutions, depending upon the place, it would be more than a non-teaching institution, because there are adjustments for the training of residents and fellows. There are they're proxies, adjustments for the treatment of higher severity illness and the maintenance of those standby services.
Right.
And then there are other adjustments that are made, like outlier payments, which essentially are those people who, in the vernacular, are train wrecks, and they end up being way outside the normal diagnosis system, where they come in with, you know, a simple trauma, mm-hmm. but it's really a very complicated trauma. They might stay several weeks or months, and so those bills can reach into the millions of dollars. We're not actually reimbursed that. What we're given is an adjustment to say, okay, we know you've taken so care of so many of those types of patients.
Right.
But there's also rural adjustments, right?
So there's Before we get to the rural, just to recapitulate, it's pretty complicated for some of our non-healthcare listeners. So basically we're saying that Medicare reimbursements to hospitals that are academic medical centers are slightly higher or just higher to varying degrees because of, one, you're subsidizing the education of tomorrow's healthcare providers.
Right. So Medicare pays probably less than 20% of the costs of training. It costs us about $150,000 a year to train a doctor all in, and it's a fraction of that Medicare pays, but...
And then they also take on student debt.
Yes, they do.
So the medical resident who's trying to become a physician will take on student debt. The Medicare reimbursement rates are higher, you said, covering 20% of that cost. How much does tuition cover?
Well, remember, in a residency, they're not paying tuition. We're paying them a stipend and benefits, so... But, you know, it's really, it's, you're talking about, I believe the last time I looked, the average stipend for a first-year resident, or what we used to call an intern, is about $48,000 or $49,000 a year. So,
and they may be, if they were a full-time attending physician, they may be making $200,000
yep.
a year. So there's
yep.
kind of a $150,000 almost contribution that the student is kind of, in a way, making by forgoing that salary increase.
Well, that would be if they were fully trained
right.
and able to care independently for patients, which they're not. So it's kind of the old apprenticeship model, except we've put a lot of regulations and standards in place through both what occurs in the health system, whether that's through Joint Commission or Medicare, or it's through the Accreditation Council for Graduate Medical Education that actually accredits the training institution. So they are there, though, to train. And you could argue that if I'm a month away mm-hmm. from finishing my residency in internal medicine, I'm pretty darn close to somebody who's a month into
yeah.
their career after their residency. Although we're finding now that, increasingly because of some restrictions we've had on things like duty hours and residency training, people are still, we're all still learning, and the goal is to create lifelong learners. So, you know, it's a question of levels of experience, and I think the doc that's making $200,000 in our institutions could probably walk across town and make $240,000. So, you know, a lot of this is really those faculty that are willing to, because the missions are important to them, and they're, again, it's may not be that their sole motivation is profit maximization. They may really enjoy teaching and say, I want to be there.
Now, you also said that the academic medical centers attract some of the sickest individuals in the community, and that may be because in an academic medical center, you support research and you support niche
right.
specialization areas, and through large patient volumes, you'll have a higher proportion of individuals with that particular condition, therefore providing the volume that leads to the expertise, and therefore, again, perpetuates that cycle by attracting more individuals from around the world, as in the case of some institutions you named previously, and therefore, by having those riskier patients, the costlier patients, you end up having higher reimbursement rates for that.
Absolutely, because we just take care of, and if you look at Medicare data, if something called the case mix index,
yeah.
which measures roughly how severely ill your patients are, ours are always 20-25% higher.
Uh-huh.
And moreover, we also get a lot of transfers in. So think about us being the safety net, not only for the community, but the safety net for other providers. So when someone does really poorly outside of our institutions, they get sent to us.
And you said there was another criteria that led to higher Medicare reimbursement rates for academic medical centers?
No, I'm just saying that there's different, these are policy payments that
right.
are, that, you know, Medicare decided a long time ago they wanted to support certain things, one of which is training institutions. They truly believed that the quality of care was higher in teaching hospitals, and they thought it was important that Medicare beneficiaries have access to these places. Similarly, there are rural adjustments made because you want to make sure mm-hmm. that those beneficiaries that are living in rural areas can go to that small hospital. And there's even whole other categories of hospitals that are paid in an entirely different way because they are so small and so critical to a community. So these are all policy payments we make within the system because these things are important to Medicare and Medicare beneficiaries. This issue of highly specialized care and the volume necessary to do a good job in caring for those patients is exactly why we have the clinical partnership we've had with the VA for 70 years.
The VA is?
The Veterans Administration Healthcare System. And if you look at the VAs, we have a 70-year connection of having formal relationships with these priority partners of academic medical centers. So down here in D.C., Hospital Center, GW, Georgetown have a relationship with them. They send trainees over there, mm-hmm. send patients over there. Where I trained at University of California, San Francisco, again, critical relationship. All of the faculty over there are faculty at the university, even though they're based at the VA. And one of the reasons we do this is because the VA simply cannot build up the transplant infrastructure, care for, you know, LVADs and highly complex cardiac care, other care. And so the academic partner makes sure that when those veterans come in and have those illnesses, our faculty are there to care for them or they're sent over to our institutions. And so it's a perfect example of this issue where, you know, volume is really key to excellence.
So you sometimes are a contributor to blogs on health affairs and the Wall Street Journal's websites. Now, on one of these, you recently posted a blog about CMS star ratings. Mm-hmm. There are 5 stars. One is poor performance. 5 stars means a hospital is exemplary. And you made a posting about how the star system may not be as transparent and as accurate as CMS hopes it would be. I'm asking this question as a follow-up to the case mix, which mm-hmm. for our listeners is on a topic of academic medical centers attracting the sicker patients. Why is it, you know, that there is this star rating system with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, which again is a federal agency that manages Medicare and Medicaid, and why is it so flawed?
So the star rating exists, I think, for a good intent, which is to give consumers, patients, better information about the places that they're choosing. And the idea would be kind of a consumer reports thing of saying, well, you know, you want to go to a place which is deemed by these quality criteria to be excellent. The challenge is the way that CMS has created the star system is it's kind of garbage in, garbage out. So it's a composite of a number of different other quality measures, but there are big problems with a lot of those other quality measures.
They're missing data in entire categories.
Right. So I can't remember the exact proportion, Jordan, but it's a higher proportion that are specialty hospitals that have gotten 5 stars that are missing half of the reported data that our more comprehensive institutions report. And because if a hospital doesn't report the data, CMS just assumes people are average.
Does that not just provide a perverse incentive for hospitals to withhold data, to not report data,
and only report the
one thing that they're positive on and therefore get average scores in the rest?
Yeah, but, you know, that's not my people. They're incredibly anal retentive. They want to report everything. They want to be careful. And, in fact, one of the underlying quality measures is something called a PSI, Patient Safety Indicator 90, which pulls in every infection and complication and all this.
It's not risk adjusted.
It's not risk adjusted, and there's something called surveillance bias, which is the more you look for it, the more likely you are to find it. We look for a lot of stuff. We have whole teams of people that are in there that are trying to do the best job by the patient as possible. Mm-hmm. So you aggregate this stuff up, and some of these flaws just get magnified. I'll give you another example would be readmissions. Mm-hmm. Conceptually, you know, as part of the ACA, Medicare said, you know, we got patients who you admit to the hospital. Mm-hmm. We're going to look at 3 conditions, heart failure and a couple others. if I discharge those patients as a hospital and they come back in 2 days, why should we pay you again for another hospitalization at the same rate we paid you for the first one? Isn't there some responsibility?
Conceptually, that's something that most people get on board with.
Absolutely reasonable. One of the challenges is that there's the readmissions period goes for 30 days. So a lot can happen in 30 days. And most of the literature that's come out since 2010, when the law was passed and then implemented a couple of years later, shows that the clinical relationship to readmission for things like, you know, did they see the doctor? Did they, you know, did you X, Y, and Z in terms of processes? Far less related to readmissions than, say, your social support and the zip code in which you live. And so this is, again, one of the underlying flaws, poverty, right? And it's the social determinants of health. And think about it this way. If I am discharged as a patient here in Bethesda, mm-hmm. I have a friend over in one of the local ERs who said, you know, I actually discharge some really sick patients because I can talk to their primary care provider or their cardiologist. I know they're going to get seen. You know, it's 2 in the morning. Mm-hmm. I know they'll get seen at 9 a.m. Mm-hmm. I know that they have access to somebody who will give them a ride. I know that they can pay for their medications and they have a pharmacy that will deliver them in the middle of the night. Mm-hmm. It's very different from, let's say, I'm a patient in East Baltimore, where you and I both went to school, and I have no social supports whatsoever. I'm unmarried. I'm trying to raise 3 kids on my own. I have to take 2 buses to get to the darn hospital. I can't afford my medications. Or let's take it one step further. How do I do a home visit if my patient is homeless? How do I make sure they're taking their medications for their heart failure if they can't even take their medications for their schizophrenia?
So hospitals are being penalized the lack of an adequate social safety net in American society.
Absolutely.
Let's transition off that topic over to you.
Uh-huh.
Dr. Atul Grover, the first thing that comes out is your title. You're a doctor.
When you say it, not when I say it.
You're a physician.
Just your dad.
So you went to medical school, ostensibly. Well, did you go to medical school so that you could see patients and treat patients? Why did you go to medical school?
To become a doctor. By the time I got to med school, I had done, as a high school student, research at the National Cancer Institute. Kept doing that every summer for 9 years, a couple of winters thrown in as well through undergrad and medical school. And so I like science.
And your dad was in medicine, right?
He was in public health. He was an epidemiologist, mm-hmm. Trained at Hopkins, worked for the federal government, retired from the federal government, so before he died. And so it was sort of, you know, and my mom was a teacher, so I liked medicine, I liked health, I liked teaching, I liked writing. And so
your siblings?
I have an older sibling. He sells insurance.
Health insurance?
No. Well, that's included in his portfolio. He's a small businessman, so he insures businesses.
So you, of the two kids, ended up following more in along your parents' footsteps.
Yeah, I'd say so. But it's just my personal interest. He was also a much better athlete than I am.
Huh. Okay. So going back to your...
People are just different.
Yeah.
So I went to med school. You know, I went to college as a biology major. Got very bored very fast. I just didn't like the 300-person lecture hall.
Yeah.
I had a little bit of, you know, attention issues going on there. And so I much preferred smaller classes where I could interact with people. So I ended up getting a degree in creative writing. I wrote poetry. I didn't even do literature for the most part. I had to take maybe 3 pre-1800s literature classes, one of which was, I'll admit now, Shakespeare on film, and that counted. Which was great if you watch like Kurosawa's Ran, and you know, it's just fabulous. So I went to med school thinking about getting a master's in fine arts, but then had great mentorship.
Went to med school thinking you might get another degree?
Yeah, actually I thought about getting that instead of med school, then maybe before med school, then maybe after med school, but then realized that the key there was just to keep writing.
Do you write now?
Only like technical stuff, unfortunately. It's been a while since.
What's the last thing you've written for fun?
Oh, you know, I keep thinking about a short story book, which is kind of a mix of clinical stories and policy stories. So I've got ideas that I've written down there. One of these days, when I get a couple months off, I don't think my employer gives sabbaticals, but you know, if they ever did, that's what I would do. But, you know, so I thought about doing all these things. And when I went to med school, it was here in D.C., 91 to 95. So it was the middle of Clinton healthcare reform efforts. We as students got very engaged in that, had a chance to.
You were in California.
No, I was here for medical school at GW.
Oh, okay.
The residency was California after that. Which, by the way, when you go to California and you say, I want to do federal policy, they just kind of look at you funny.
Like, what is it?
Right. So, you know, we just got very engaged in that. And I think the more I went through, the more I reaffirmed my love of medicine and particularly of working with patients, but still knowing that I wanted to continue those other things of writing and teaching. I've always loved to teach. And what better way to do that than academic medicine?
How does your training in your medical training from medical school inform your policymaking decisions?
Because I know what happens when the rubber hits the road. I mean, I know what passes the laugh test and what doesn't. And so when you have things like readmissions policy and you can go to CMS's leadership and say, come on, does this make any sense to you? And then you have a deeper discussion about what it means to have disparities and, you know, certainly understanding that you don't want to entrench disparities and try and come up with policies that allow you to handle both, both the provider side and the patient side, equity. Mm-hmm. And we've done that now. Unfortunately, it took legislation to do it because CMS was not particularly cooperative under the last administration around this area.
And the alternative would have been, for our listeners, regulations, which they could have promulgated
right.
on their own.
Right. Congress writes the law, but it's pretty vague. It says pass, you know, put in a readmissions program.
Mm-hmm.
And the secretary, they either say shall or they may consider all these factors.
Mm-hmm.
They said may, and you know, socioeconomic status was one of those factors, and CMS chose not to in their rules, in their rulemaking process. So you can always go back and do that, and that's in those conversations. And often now, there's been several leaders at CMS that are in fact physicians
mm-hmm.
who have been terrific in actually getting this. Challenge sometimes comes down on the frontline staff of being able to convince them what it's really like and what their rules mean for patients and for providers.
So basically your medical, and then obviously you went to get a PhD after you went to medical school because you just couldn't stay in school long enough.
Yeah, that was, you know, it was kind of serendipitous. I came back to Hopkins to do training in health services research and policy. Then sort of worked with, again, Professor Anderson doing health economics. And as it happened, they allowed me to take coursework, get credit for the research I was doing. The challenging part was writing a dissertation, which I, you know, will say I give a lot of credit to people with PhDs. In a lot of ways, it's harder than it was to get an MD because it's all self-directed.
Mm-hmm.
For an MD, you pretty much show up.
Do what you're told.
Do what you're told. You know, make sure you learn what you're learning. Be nice to people. Be on time. Ask how you can help, and you do just fine.
Yeah. Huh. So you – well, okay. Well, we're approaching the end of the podcast, and you clearly are a lifelong learner, having collected a variety of letters after your name. You clearly have expressed an interest in teaching and in medicine. You've explained why you're – you feel as though the AAMC is something that suits you well, but something I'd like you to address now as we conclude this podcast is your time at AAMC or your time doing research in healthcare and in medicine. What is it that you hope you have achieved through your work to advance the public interest? Why are you so interested in improving healthcare in America? And at the end of your career, what do you hope to have accomplished? What will be your legacy after having spent your lifetime in public health?
Well, depending on who's listening to the podcast, we're making America great. Again, you know, if you think about American healthcare, the system is clunky, but we have the best healthcare providers in the world and the best, in many ways, system in the world in terms of getting people the care they need when they're very sick. We don't do so good at the beginning of life and maybe through age 64. We're getting better at it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that, you know, if you think about what makes American healthcare great, it's America's academic medical centers, right? It's where discovery and training and clinical care come together to really create that next generation of medicine and the next generation of cures. And so I think that making these institutions stronger, which hopefully I've been in a position to help do, is what makes American medicine great. So we're making it great again. If you want to keep it great, do not let anything bad happen to these institutions. And I think it's easy to, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, forget about the long-term investments that you need to make in American healthcare, and this is part of that investment. So I'm very proud to have done my part to make sure that these institutions can actually do what they want to do, which is help their communities and help them get care today, but also think about the new care of tomorrow, the new models we're going into. We've been leaders in all these things, from bundling and next-gen ACOs and everything else, to really discovering the next generation of treatments, therapies, and cures.
And that has been Dr. Atul Grover, the Executive Vice President at the Association for American Medical Colleges, the former Chief Public Policy Officer and Chief Advocacy Officer at the AAMC, the former Chief Medical Officer at HRSA's Center for Workforce Studies, and a current professor at Hopkins and GW, who speaks about working to advance the cause and advance the interests of the AAMC as a means of helping those in greatest need. He sees himself as helping students, advancing medical educational opportunities, which in turn address access issues in the future as more people get coverage or increase in number of providers that either stabilizes or increase or reduces the ratio of providers to beneficiaries and citizens around a nation. He speaks essentially, it gets technical at times, money and policies and what the payment rates are. But in essence, Dr. Grover speaks about making American healthcare great again by ensuring that the sickest, that the students who wish to learn, that rural populations are served, and that research is being done. And clinical care, in some of the most cutting-edge clinical care, is being advanced, funded. Basic science research is going into clinical care. Basically, Atul speaks about advancing the public interest by advocating for major bedrocks of American healthcare, those primary big brand names, as he mentioned earlier, that really define what healthcare is when you think of it in your mind. And his legacy to America is one in which we provide more opportunities for more Americans to achieve their own potential due to the promotion of their wellness through the delivery of high-quality care. So, Atul, I'd like to thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Jordan.
And that has been episode 156 of Public Interest Podcast with your host, Jordan Cooper, where we interview politicians, activists, advocates, and others who seek to improve the state of the world. I'll remind you to subscribe at publicinterestpodcast.com, listen on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Blueberry, Player FM, Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. And should you wish to speak to Atul, you can call 240-630-0380, and your voicemail will be conveyed to him. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.